This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer! What a great day for another episode of Solve It for Kids. And today's guest is going to bring the science right into our own neighborhoods.
Oh, this sounds exciting. What question are we going to be solving today?
How do you meet the moths that are in your neighborhood?
How do you meet moths in your neighborhood? Oh, this sounds really fun. Who is our guest today, Jeff?
Our guest today is Dr. Lori Griffin Burns. She is not only a faculty member and instructor at two different colleges in New England, she is also a scientist by training and a storyteller by inclination.
Oh, this sounds like so much fun. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lori.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with both of you.
Oh, so I'm so excited and curious about the science in your neighborhood. But what I always love to ask is, how did you start or how did you become a scientist? Like, where did your love of science come from?
Well, you know, for me, the love of science came from really great teachers. It was my high school biology teacher really inspired me to pursue a career in science.
Do you remember that biology teacher's name?
Mr. Jim Micarelli. Yes.
Of course.
He ran a research program at our high school, which was very unusual at that time. And I did a research project on fingerprinting and a research project on earthworms, which those experiences have stayed with me all these years. And that really inspired me to go to school and be trained as a scientist myself.
All right. And so I was just about to ask why biology and not a different type of science, but having those research projects sounds a lot like lab work, so a lot less classroom instruction and more really hands-on science that started you off in high school.
Yes, absolutely. That was the case. Although I will say when I went on from there and I got more specialized in science, my degree is actually in biochemistry and I worked a lot in a research lab as a molecular biologist. And so that means I was really interested in understanding how the tiny molecules inside of our cells work. I wanted to know what those molecules were and what they did. And so later in my scientific training, I did spend a lot more time in a research lab. And then I sort of evolved again into someone who's really more interested in studying the world around me and the non-human creatures that live in it with me.
Right. And then you took all of that and turned it into writing books for kids, right?
Yes, exactly. So I was working as a scientist for quite some time. And then when I started a family and had young children of my own at home, I took a little break from that research job. Right. And it was while I was on that break that I began writing about science stories for young people, because I had young people now living in my house and I was super in tune with what was interesting to them and what they wanted to know. And a lot of their questions got me curious. And so really my kids pushed me into the writing and I've now been doing that for more than 15 years, writing books about science. And
wow.
Science.
They're amazing books. I'll just say that they're amazing books. I've read them. Yeah.
I love the way you just said that, in that when you had kids, little people in your house, their questions sparked your curiosity.
Absolutely.
That is super cool.
Yeah. And my kids were really proud of that back in the day, that they could ask questions that really inspired books. I mean, several of my books are dedicated to my kids, and they really did do a lot of the book research with me and were super instrumental in helping keep my point of view where it needed to be when I was writing about these topics for young people. You know, it's great. I miss having them around now that they're grown.
Now that they're grown and they have a completely different view. Yeah, I'm in the same boat with you. My kids have inspired me to write some of the topics that I did. But what I want to talk about is meeting moths in your neighborhood. I mean, wow, how can we do this? And why should we?
Well, I'll tackle why should we first. There are lots of answers to that question, and everyone will have their own answers to why would they like to meet the moths that live in their neighborhood. For me, it was quite simple. I began to notice, and maybe you have as well, and maybe your listeners have as well, that when I left my porch lights on at night after dark, occasionally I would leave them on too long or maybe even overnight, I would find insects around them. Right. And sometimes on really hot summer nights, lots of insects, flying insects. And to me, they looked moth-like. They were small in most cases. They were drab in color. Mm-hmm. They were winged. I could tell they were scaly wings. And so I knew I had moths around here, but I didn't really know much else. I didn't even know why they came to my lights. But then I gave myself an opportunity to learn a little more. There's a nature center near to me. Nature centers are wonderful places to go and get some inspiration for work, research, studying you can do in your own backyard, in your own neighborhood green spaces. So the nature center near me was doing they were hosting a naturalist. So a man who is really focused on understanding the non-human world around him as well. And he was an expert in moths. And I thought, I will go and learn from an expert because I'm a very much a beginner, a curious beginner.
Right.
So I went to this lecture and the man I learned from, who became a mentor for me in moth watching, his name is David Small. And he showed some incredible pictures of moths that came to his lights at his house.
Wow.
These were not small drab moths. These were incredibly diverse in color and shape and size. And he had these very close-up images where I could see the feathery antenna. I could see the individual colored scales.
That's
I could count
cool.
their legs, all those things. And I, of course, wanted to know how he did that.
Right.
And it turns out that he didn't just rely on his porch lights. He drew moths into his yard. There were two things that he did that I wasn't doing. First of all, and this one your listeners are going to like, he stayed up really late.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Many people know that moths tend to fly at night, and butterflies, who are very closely related insects, tend to fly during the day. But what people don't realize is that the later it gets, the more variety and diversity of moths you will see. So if you're only staying up until just after dark, you're not going to see the full group of moths that live near you. So you have to stay up pretty late. The second thing that I wasn't doing was using the right kinds of lights. So Dave taught me that you can draw, moths are attracted to lights for reasons we don't completely understand.
Right.
But they're attracted to certain kinds of lights more than others. So they will come.
No idea.
Yes. They will come to your regular incandescent light bulbs.
Right.
Okay.
But if you have UV lights in your yard, not many of us do, but you can purchase such lights, and moths are very attracted to them. There's another type of light. Right. The lights differ in the wavelengths of light they produce.
Right. Right.
Or the brightness of light they're producing. I've had the most success with ultraviolet lights and mercury micro bulbs. These are stronger lights in different wavelengths, and they attract moths much, much more strongly.
Now, how did he get the pictures, though? Did he have some amazing photography set up?
Yes, very good question. So I should tell you that in addition to having special lights, Dave also made bait. So he would create. So I wonder if you all know what moths eat.
Leaves?
As caterpillars, they eat leaves. You're right, Jen. When they're caterpillars, they eat leaves. But when they're adults, if they eat...
Turns out, I have no idea.
But if they do, like butterflies, they have sipping mouth parts, and they will sip nectar from flowers or sap from trees. So you can create at home using crushed fruit. I use bananas, a little bit of alcohol. So you need an adult to help you with that, and some sugar. And you can mix that up. There are lots of places where you can find recipes for bait. You essentially make a nectar-like substance, a sugary substance that they will like to sip. And if you put that out, paint it onto your tree trunks or your fence posts or what have you, that will also attract the moths to your yard. So those are the two tricks I use, lights and bait. And so this question of how you get those close photos, if you have those two things to invite your more moths that live near you to come to your place and check the lights out and check the bait out, I usually hang a sheet very near to the lights. The moths will be attracted to the lights. They get a little overstimulated by the lights, to be honest. It doesn't appear to harm them, But they do eventually settle down and stay very still. And if I have a sheet hung near the lights, they will perch on that sheet very still for the most part.
And that's
when I can go in with my camera.
Yep. A lovely background.
Yes.
While they're staying still for you.
Yes, exactly.
And they're perfectly well fed.
And you can really get to know them.
And hence, you can meet the moths in your neighborhood.
There you go.
No kidding. Yeah. And talk about a children's book that I feel like you were just writing as you were telling us that story of making your own little concoction and where are we going to put it outside and having the lights and that. This sounds like fun.
We call that kind of after dark party where you intentionally invite moths into your space a mothball. And so
is that real? That's what you call them? Or did you make that up?
Yes, that's, I learned that term from Dave Small, the man I mentioned to you, who became my mothball mentor.
Mm-hmm. That's just cool.
And so the book that I wrote is called You're Invited to a Mothball. And in it, it shows you all these things that I've just told you that you can do to make your space more welcoming to the moths who live in your neighborhood. And then you can spend some time studying them, trying to figure out who they are. All these moths have their own names. There are thousands and thousands of moth species in this world.
I did not know that.
Yes.
Well, and I didn't know that moths are colored. Like, you know, when you think of moths, you think like what you said initially, they're kind of brown and maybe drab looking or whatever, maybe have patterns, but what colors can you find on moths?
Oh, goodness, lots. I mean, many, many of them are sort of drab in color. And when you think about it, for insects that are going to be out and about, so to speak, in the dark, color is probably a little less important than those insects that are out and about during the day. Sure. But it's really not true that all moths are drab and uncolored. So there's a moth that's very common where I live in Massachusetts called the rosy maple moth that I've had young friends call the cotton candy moth because it's bright yellow and beautiful pink together. It's a really beautiful moth, very colorful. And it's one of those moths that you can sometimes see during the day. And they're much more common than I ever would have thought before I began putting out lights and bait in my yard.
Okay. So as you were describing that very colorful cotton candy moth, and you can see it during the day, it spurs the question, how can we tell the difference between a moth and a butterfly?
This is a very good question. It can be difficult. In general, the insects that look like that family that you see at night are going to be moths, and the ones you see in the daylight are going to be butterflies. Mm-hmm. But I've been told by the experts, and this is a good place for me to remind you all, I am not a moth expert. This is a new passion of mine, but you can quickly gain a lot of skill and get to know moths by doing this kind of work. In any event, so the experts that I have talked to, including Dave, tell me that the best way, the most reliable way, is to look at their antennae. So butterflies have clubbed antennae. So they'll be a long sort of stick-like appendage with a knob or a ball or a club on the end. It looks like a bulge on the end. Moths don't have clubbed antennae. They either have straight antennae that end in a point or they will have very feathered, elaborate antennae, but they'll never have clubbed antennae. So that's a really good way to tell one from the other.
Okay. And that's a good way to get up close.
Yes.
And learn more about them. Because you'll have to be close enough to see that.
Right.
So if you have all these moths there, other than taking the photos, do they bring benefits to have them in your backyard or your neighborhood?
Well, you know, just like butterflies, through the act of sipping nectar from flowers, there's some pollination that work that moths do. So for that reason, they're important. But the adult moth is just one stage in a four-part life cycle of the moth. So adult moths will lay eggs. Okay. And out of those eggs, that's the first stage. Out of those eggs will hatch caterpillars. Scientists tend to call that stage the larval stage or a larva. The larval stage is the second stage. Then there's this transition period when that grub-like caterpillar is transforming into what we know as an adult butterfly. And that transformation process, which is somewhat mysterious and completely amazing, happens in the pupal stage, in this very quiet stage. In moths, there's usually a cocoon around the pupa. Right. right? So all four of those life stages are important, and it's good to encourage moths in all of those stages to be around for the pollinating purposes and lots of other jobs that they do in our environment that we want to protect, like all pollinators.
This is really cool. Like, I can't wait to go home and check out all the different moths.
I should warn you that there are some pitfalls and some hard parts, and we should make
sure
about those.
Okay, what are those?
So first of all, some of these lights, you should never look at these lights, right? The UV lights and these mercury vapor lights are very strong. It's probably part of how they're attracting moths and sometimes other insects to them, but they're not good for human eyes. And so I tell the folks who come to my house to watch moths with me not to stare at the lights, to stare at the moths. Also, adult moths don't live in all parts of the world at all times of year. So moth watching where I live in New England can only happen in the summertime. There aren't many moths. There's some moths in late spring. There are some moths in early winter.
Early fall. Okay.
In early fall, there are no moths. Well, right. That's not even true. There are only a couple moths that can survive here in the winter. So you can only moth watch at certain times. And then, of course, you have to get the right conditions. So, for example, here in New England, in the summer of 2021, it has been very, very wet. And many nights I set up my lights and put out my bait and I had no visitors at all. And it's mostly because it was pouring rain or drizzling or rather cool. And moth watching is an activity that really is the most successful when the moths are the most abundant. And that is the super hot, dry nights of summer.
And that makes me think that moths are very much akin to humans. If it's raining in, it's cold, we stay inside. So if anybody was around trying to human watch, the same types of weather situations wouldn't be good for it.
If you were going to moss watch, if you were a person who was very interested in mosses or amphibians or mushrooms, this summer has been great for mushroom watching where I live because it's wetter than it's been in a very long time. And that's a great, so when the moths aren't out because it's raining, you have to think about what you might be able to see, what is out there instead.
Sure. Yeah, that's great.
So I'm not usually the guy that makes bigger leaps in asking the questions because Jen's much smarter than I am. But I have a question about moths, a bigger question. How do moths help our ecosystem? Where do they fit? Are they doing as much pollination as bees type of thing? Are they good for an environment? Can they be bad?
So this is a really good question, and I think it has a lot of answers. So the question of whether they're good or bad, I think it depends on what moths we're talking about. So like many insects, so all of our insect life, all of our animal life lives have evolved over time in certain locations usually. Yeah, but since the advent of human travel, a lot of them have been moved to places that they didn't evolve to exist. And so you have sometimes species that you don't want in an environment because there are no natural predators for them and they can cause a lot of damage unchecked as a result of that. So there are cases where there are certain types of moths that would be classified as an invasive species in one place.
Okay.
Whereas wherever that moth comes from, they're a perfectly fine and helpful part of the ecosystem. So it can be a little bit complicated, I guess. But in general, I try to encourage, just like I would all insects, to feel welcome here and happy here. Because in my mind, and again, I'm not a moth expert, but in my mind, the pollination services are super important. And I welcome all pollinators here. So whether you do a lot of the job, like the bees, I think the local bee population probably does the majority of the pollinating here in my garden and on my property. But moths I know do some as well. And they're doing it at a time when those bees aren't out and about and doing a job. So, you know, so in that way, I'm trying to encourage them.
So because we've talked about, we've had people on here talking about biodiversity and how important that is. So I'm assuming moths play a part of that. Is there are there certain plants that you can put into your neighborhood or your backyard to bring in moths or other pollinators or anything like that?
Well, this is another really fascinating aspect of moths and butterflies. And that is that most of them, almost all of them, have a special relationship with a plant or a few plant species. And so many people don't realize this, but a butterfly will not just, or a moth will not just lay its egg on any plant.
Oh.
It will lay its egg only on the plant that its larvae is capable of eating. And so I'll switch to butterflies here just because there's a very common example that probably you and many of your listeners will know. But the monarch butterfly caterpillar, you will only ever find that caterpillar on milkweed plants.
Milkweed. That's right. Right.
That's because that's the host plant for that species. Almost all butterfly species and all moth species have one or a few host plants with which they're closely related. So if you do not have any milkweed at all in your neighborhood, you will most likely not have monarch butterfly larvae and pupae. You may have some butterflies who fly through.
Look
for milkweed.
Looking for the milkweed that they don't see.
And keep going. So if you have favorite moth species, then planting the host for that species would be a great way for you to up your chances of seeing that particular moth. Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. Yes.
Exactly right. That makes total sense. And I feel like this is a story of like the monarch butterfly is the celebrity that everybody knows about. Like I even knew milkweed. I was like, I think I know that's the one.
Yes.
But I don't know any host plants for moths, and they are just as populous, and they are everywhere from New England to Florida to Colorado to cover the three of us. Moths are everywhere, but everybody knows about the monarch butterfly.
Yeah.
Not everybody knows as much about moths.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of how your storytelling as inspiration came about, where you wanted to start telling stories for kids?
Well, a little bit. I think so. I mean, I can think of a particular situation with my young children where I first tuned in as someone who considered herself a scientist and maybe not a naturalist. I think now I would try to lay claim to both of those titles. A naturalist is just someone who's really spends a lot of time paying attention and studying the natural world, right? The non-human plants and animals. And
I love the non-human. That's great.
Yeah. So when my kids were small, they would, whenever they found a caterpillar, they would like to keep it for a while, you know, in a jar and look at it. And the rule.
My daughter and her neighborhood friends.
Yes. So the rule in our house has always been, that's fine with me under two conditions. We have to know its host plant. We have to know what leaves it can eat. Because if we take that caterpillar in the house and just give it any old leaf, the chances are it's not going to survive because they can't eat just anything. So unless they're a generalist, but more often than not, like I've said, they have a relationship with a specific species of plant or several species of plants. So there was a time when I told my kids this and they had found a caterpillar. They didn't know it wasn't on a leaf. It was on the driveway. And so my three children on their hands and knees following this caterpillar as it crawled slowly across the driveway. Because I had told them, if you watch it until it goes to a plant and you see it chew on a leaf, you can keep it. You can bring it in the house for a little while and we'll watch it. That was a very hard task because I think this caterpillar had probably fallen from or blown in from a tree nearby.
Oh, no.
It can be a little difficult. However, if you find a caterpillar on a leaf and you see it munching on that leaf, which you can do, then you know that that's its host plant. Even if you don't know the name of the plant or the caterpillar, you can be pretty safe. And then you'd have to make a safe place for the caterpillar to live and commit to either releasing it very soon after you've watched it or making sure you get fresh leaves for it very regularly, at least once, if not twice.
I'm guessing that was rule number two. I was just about to ask, what is rule number two?
Put it back right where you found it. Yes, because these are living creatures.
So what I think is cool, and we've talked about this with many of our guests, is how you start out in the lab working as a biochemist, doing biochemistry and stuff with the human body. And then, boom, you kind of switch to becoming a naturalist.
Mm.
So talk a little bit about what we like to tell kids is, I mean, having raised three, and I've raised three kids, kids these days kind of feel like when they're in grade school or high school, what do you want to be? And they have to pick one career. But talk to them a little bit about how you can change and just shift directions.
Yes. not only can you change, I think it's a great opportunity just knowing that you can change because your interests change over time, right? And your circumstances sure. change over time. So for me, when I was younger and unattached and unmarried and no children and no one really needing my attention in the ways that a family did, I could spend all my days in the lab working with yeast cells and understanding how they work. And when my situation changed and I was a little bit older and I had children that were my responsibility and along with my husband's, of course, but my situation was different. And then right. I was still very passionate about a scientific way of viewing the world. I was not asking questions anymore of my yeast cells in the lab. I suddenly was asking questions of what I was seeing around me. And the question was, where is that caterpillar going? What That's leaf cool. will it end up on? And my lab assistants, luckily, could then follow the caterpillar and help me figure that out. We have committed ourselves. My kids are grown and don't live here in this house anymore. But while they were here, and I'm committed to being the world's leading expert on this place where I live. And what I mean by that is I can tell you which kinds of moths and butterflies I've seen this summer. I can tell you which kinds of frogs and salamanders I've seen. I've seen a snake last night. I saw a I saw two things. I saw a flying squirrel yesterday, which I haven't wow. seen in a very long time. Oh, and I saw cool. a pine sawyer, but a kind I'd never seen before with these really large antenna. I've never seen one here before. And I make note of that. I've just noted everything that lives here. So if there's a scientist out there who wants to understand the biodiversity of this small town that I live in Massachusetts, they should come talk to me because I have really good records of what I've seen here. And anybody can do that. You yeah. both could be that expert where you live. And every listener you have could be that expert on their neighborhood or their yard or their playground or what have you.
And it's all I'm picturing is regardless of neighborhood, but obviously my brain is going to my neighborhood. All I can picture is you must be so much more in tune and paying attention to being in the moment, which we hear about and we talk about, or we're reading an article on our phone about being in the moment.
Yes.
But you are actually noticing leaves and bugs and animals and what they're actually eating. Is that caterpillar actually nibbling on that leaf or is it crawling across that leaf to get to the next plant over?
Right.
And what a great way to disconnect from, whether it's kid listeners or adult listeners, to disconnect from schoolwork or work and our stuff to yes. just notice what's around us.
Yes, absolutely, Jeff. It's really one of my favorite things to do. And I will tell you that this amazing thing happens. Just what you say happens. You start to notice more simply by mm-hmm. paying attention. You start to see more. And over time, when you've been doing it for several years or many years, in my case, I'm older now. I've done this for a long time. I now feel like I understand these life cycles that are happening around me in ways
okay.
that I know what time of year I can expect to see the rosy maple moth in what time of
sure.
year I won't.
Yeah,
I know
that's cool.
when to expect
that is cool.
the barn swallows to be laying babies. And I know when to expect that I won't see the barn swallows anymore. And it's, you can learn that in books, of course, but it stays with me better when I'm observing
sure.
it myself in my own little world, my own little part of the world.
I always say science is best in action, right?
Yes.
Yes.
It stays
sorry.
With you.
Jen, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I do have a follow-up. Because you are noticing so much more when you're outside and you're noticing all of the different things, how many times do you lose track of time and like forget to wander home?
Very, very often. The dog can attest that our walks are really just short rambles through the meadow that's nearby to here. And I take a lot of insect photographs. I do lose track of time a lot. And also I get in trouble because if you borrow my phone and say that you want to see, you know, a picture of one of my children, I often don't have them because mostly my phone is the bugs and the 72 flying squirrel pictures I took yesterday and, and that kind of thing. But luckily, I have people around me who are pretty supportive of this habit of mine.
Right now, I honestly, just in general of the way, you know, American children are, I have a 10-year-old, so I'm still in that raising and She loves being outside, but she also loves being on her tablet and messaging with her friends and stuff. And I can't think of a better pastime right now that needs to spread like wildfire than just going outside and losing track of time.
And the thing is, you know, there's this sometimes this mistaken idea when I talk to students in school, I think sometimes they think that all the cool stuff has been figured out. Like we know everything that there is to know about.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. Right.
But it's just not true. There's so much we don't know yet. And for some of it, you know, it'd be nice to have some fancy equipment and a research lab and that kind of thing. But for a lot of it, you can ask the questions in your own yard. Maybe we do know it already, but that doesn't mean you can't find it out again. Right. And figuring it out on your own is so much more satisfying. So, I mean, that's sort of my big message. Like, we can all be scientists. We can all look at the world through a scientific lens and ask those questions and then think of ways that we can figure out the answer. Can I design a little test that will help me figure out this answer?
Exactly.
Right.
So you watch the animals in the backyard, which I did too. But then with my book, I did beastly bionics. So you watch them figure out how they can be. We can use biomimicry to make things that help humans. So see, there's always something you can do.
Yes, it's so true. It's so true. And it really does start with, I think, the paying attention and then the asking of questions. And any of us can do that. You don't have to be grown up and have a lab coat and a fancy science degree, right?
That's very true.
Perfect lead in. Since you don't have to be a grown up and have a fancy lab coat, we ask all of our guests to bring along a challenge that we could have our listeners do. So I am super excited to hear what yours will be.
Right. So I kind of showed my hand a little bit with this, but I was going to challenge your listeners to really think about what it would mean to become the world's leading expert on the non-human life in their neighborhood. So the flora and fauna of where they live. In your yard, if you have a yard, but your nearest green space, a relative's place, your schoolyard, where are the plants and animals and other organisms in your neighborhood? Who are they? Where are they on any given day? And it's really as simple as paying attention, but also I'd really challenge that added step of keeping track of what you see and where. And that's keeping a notebook, dragging that around with you and paying attention to those little observations that you make.
Nice. Yep.
That's great. Nice. Now, before we let you go, we have to tell us a little bit more about your book, where we can find it, where we can find information about you.
Okay, so you can
always find need everybody to know that Cinderella's ball is not the only ball. And now we've all been invited to a moth ball.
Right. You're all invited to a moth ball. So you're invited to a moth ball. The subtitle is A Nighttime Insect Celebration. And you can find this book anywhere books are sold. And I should tell you, because your listeners can't see me holding it up right now, it's illustrated with photographs by an amazingly talented friend of mine, Ellen Harris-Samowicz, also lives here in Massachusetts, who helped me design and host the mothballs at my house in my yard, where we took all the photos for this book. So they're all taken at night. You'll get an up-close view of many of the moths that surprised us that night, including the rosy maple moth, who I've told you about. And I've written about a lot of other topics too. I think if this idea of becoming the expert in your neck of the woods is appealing, then a book I wrote called Citizen Scientists might be a nice book, because it's really about how you can help scientists collect data on whatever they're studying in your part of the world.
And there are a lot of citizen science projects out there on all different types of sciences.
Yes.
Animals, dirt, space, astronomy, all sorts. Mm-hmm. So that's a great one.
And what is your website? Where can they find you?
LoreeBurns.com. And my name is spelled a little differently. It's L-O-R-E-E. BURNS.com.
Awesome. This has been a fabulous talk today, Dr. Lori. Thank you so much for being on Solve It for Kids.
Thank you, Jen. And thank you, Jeff. It was really a pleasure to be here. I enjoyed it a lot.
As did we.
All right. I have to be honest. When I knew we were going to be solving how to meet moths in our neighborhood, I didn't know if I was going to like it or want to do it afterwards. I cannot wait to get home and get outside with my daughter and check out how many different moths are in my neighborhood. What about you, Jennifer?
Oh, I think this is so cool. I totally want to have a moth ball in my backyard now. I mean, right? Invite all your friends and all of the other little creatures. This is what I love, is science in action. And you just get to watch it happen and learn all their names. Oh, I love it.
This is definitely science in action, and it's right in our neighborhoods. Dr. Laurie talked about it perfectly in that when she goes outside, she now understands the cycles of her neighborhood of when to expect certain types of moths or certain types of animals and certain types of plants. And I think we can all do that in our own neighborhoods now.
Yeah, and so don't forget to go to our website, solveitforkids.com. We'll have more information about Dr. Laurie. She's going to give us a little video and some links that will help you figure out how to create your own moth ball in your backyard. Plus, we always do a giveaway of a book, which will, of course, be her book. But there will be other books that you can take a look at. So again, solveitforkids.com. And then if you find some cool moths, tag us on our social media, which is at KidsSolve on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
That's right. And once you're done listening to this episode, be ready for our next episode of
Solve It for Kids.